You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the combined July-August 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Right-wing conspiracy, traitors among us. Pop culture goes soft on some of the more controversial women in American history, by Sonia Soraya. Opening photo, Kate Blanchett playing Phyllis Schlafly in the miniseries Mrs. America. The people who drive pop culture seem mystified by Republican women. Perhaps it's simply that by design, they seem to recede in plain sight. The Barbara Bushes and Nancy Reagans of the world, with their out-of-date hairstyles, monochromatic twin sets, and strings of demure pearls. Our biopics and investigative reports rarely delve into their psyche, so thoroughly do these women fulfill our ideas of a type that the mind glosses over them and moves on to the man they are invariably standing next to. For all that Hollywood and the mainstream media are supposed to be a hotbed of liberal propaganda, we pull our punches when it comes to the tales of handmaidens of conservative politics. If women's suffrage anticipated a voting bloc comprised of women voting for women's issues, the 2016 election shredded that notion. An oft-cited statistic based on exit polls is that 53% of white female voters cast their ballots for Trump, choosing not just a male candidate over a female one, but a proud sexual predator at that. The reality is that the woman voter has always been driven by more than identity politics. Women still oppose the Equal Rights Amendment, just as women opposed suffrage in 1920. Many American women today oppose paid family leave and raucously campaign against abortion access. But on TV and in movies, where character is built on identity and where conflict must move toward resolution, this reality is difficult to convey. Characterization is an attempt to evoke empathy. When Hollywood takes on conservative women, the empathy often feels grafted on, sometimes shamelessly. Consider the 2011 film The Iron Lady, which won Meryl Streep an Oscar for her sensitive portrayal of dying Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Screenwriter A.B. Morgan used Thatcher's dementia as a way to explore the politician's uneasy legacy. But the illness, a tragedy for anyone, became a cloying veil that obscured Thatcher's real effect on her nation. Former London Mayor Ken Livingstone put it this way at the time of Thatcher's death. She created today's housing crisis. She created the banking crisis. And she created the benefits crisis. The late Prime Minister sent British troops to train the Khmer Rouge, befriended the dictator Augusto Pinochet, and demonized the gay community. Under her rule, poverty and inequality spiked in the United Kingdom, and the country has arguably never recovered. This is who Streep humanized with her extraordinary gifts. Imagine a liberal female politician being treated to this kind of hagiography. Hillary Clinton, say. Imagine the vitriol that would follow. Women with conservative politics get to have it both ways. Thanks to feminists laboriously pushing society into the modern era, they have the advantage of being a protected class. Yet conservative white women in particular also have an ideology that elevates them over women from other racial or socioeconomic backgrounds. They believe they're superior to the rest of their gender. The writer Ariel Levy calls them loophole women and become honorary men. Phyllis Schlafly might be the quintessential loophole woman, at least as portrayed in Davi Waller's immersive, maddening series, Mrs. America. Cate Blanchett plays Schlafly as a woman who uses the ERA as a platform for her own devouring political ambitions and ends up throwing the women's movement under the bus. The series shies away from exploring Schlafly's ideology too closely, though, even as the character forms a shaky alliance with homophobes and the KKK. Mrs. America brilliantly portrays the how of Schlafly, but the why of her remains out of reach. I don't mean to pick on Waller's show. The fact is, it does more to understand the Republican woman than most. The issue here is a collective difficulty with understanding and engaging with the conditions under which an empowered woman sides against empowering other women, sides with a system that continues to exploit them even as we speak. Hollywood's lesser efforts often end up caught between contempt and confusion, turning their subjects into caricature. Last year's movie Bombshell from director Jay Roach is a potent example. Yes, the women of Fox News end up taking down harasser-in-chief Roger Ailes, led by Gretchen Carlson's lawsuit. But with Megyn Kelly in particular, the film seems to throw up its hands in confusion, airing the most toxic on-air clips from her tenure in the background of scenes where she struggles in the face of an institutional shakedown. The movie's poignancy is in how these women, invariably blonde and leggy, never expected to need feminism's protections, let alone to seek them out. They were too good for feminism, but at least in the eyes of the state of New Jersey, feminism was not too good for them. A telling detail, the women rarely, if ever, speak to each other. The law protects their gender, but it can't inspire a sisterhood. Kelly's reprehensible politics didn't stop her from becoming a feminist darling of sorts. The same narrative has aided and abetted real-life Trump advisors Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Kellyanne Conway, and Hope Hicks, whose politics are often presented as a mere appendage to their careers, a case of team loyalty and little else. The failure of imagination as to what motivates these women leads to either breathless speculation about their secret inner conflict of virtually every news item about Hicks, or certainty that on some level they're really feminist. Kelly, the reality is that these women have pledged allegiance to the patriarchy. Trump values Sanders, Hicks, Conway, and his new spokeswoman, Kayleigh McEnany, solely for their loyalty to him. And as he keeps reminding us, his daughter Ivanka is impressive because she's very pretty. For all that these women claim to be liberated and disingenuously use feminism as a shield, it's telling how reluctant they are to become leaders in their own right, instead of mouthpieces and extensions of men. As Sanders offhandedly told Marie Claire in 2011, "I'm a total daddy's girl. I learned at a very early age that if I said daddy in just the right way, I could pretty much get anything I wanted." Spike Lee leaves no doubt as to the motivations of the conservative women in his movie, Black Klansmen. A group of white couples, Klansmen and their wives, gather in an empty classroom to watch D.W. Griffith's landmark racist film, The Birth of a Nation. The mood is celebratory. With short, brutal strokes, Lee constructs the tribal, racist worldview of these women and their men, a hierarchy where their comfort is built on the backs of others. No, Not all Republican women are white nationalists, but as Seward Darby wrote for Harper's and expands upon in Sisters in Hate, out this month, white women have long been essential helpmeets to white nationalism, which the alt-right has adopted nearly wholesale. It's baffling, because white nationalism often goes hand in hand with misogynist rhetoric, reinforcing the role of the woman as separate and distinct from the man's, and sometimes even claiming that the wombs of white women belong to white men outright. Some women are content with circumscribed power, as long as it upholds their racial narrative. Maybe the problem is that any attempt to penetrate these hateful ideologies is met with the blinding defense of belief, as if a belief cannot be interrogated or built on rotten foundations. Imagine a world where we could dissect the pro-life movement's suspiciously recent rise to the forefront of evangelical priorities, or note that as women we have gained political power, they have steadily lost control over what happens inside their own uteruses. We may be more liberated than ever, but we do not live in that world. If you want to see TV and film truly explore morally compromised women, complicit in corporate greed and government surveillance and outright murder, your best bet is science fiction. Try Westworld. As we hurtle toward the 2020 election, our blindness to what creates and motivates these women feels like a ticking bomb. The less we understand their motivations, the better it is for them. They remain shielded by our tied tongues and politesse. Perhaps this absence is why the term Karen has become so indispensable in the online discourse of 2020. A nickname drawn from African-American vernacular, a Karen is a type. Lately, the type of woman who protests pandemic lockdown because she needs to get her nails done, but more broadly, the type of white woman who calls the police to report an infringement on her privilege, even when she's the one breaking the rules. It's not the most precise language. White nationalist racist gender traitor seems a bit stronger, but it gets us to some kind of understanding. It's a start. Thank you. Powderhorn. There went the neighborhood. Racism has always been a problem in my Minneapolis. By Safi Hallen Barra. On May 26th, I woke up to the news that an African-American man named George Floyd, 46 years old, was killed in front of Cup Foods, an Arab-American corner store located 12 blocks away from me. The owner of Cup Foods, Mahmoud Amam Yaila, had received a call from one of his employees that an officer, who we all know now was Derek Chauvin, was killing a man in front of the store, the same man that another employee moments before had called 911 on. Over the next 24 hours, the solution Abumiale proposed, calling the police on the police after a young clerk had already called the police, stitched itself into a human centipede of poor crisis management. Those 12 blocks have always felt shorter than the sprawl of Lake Street, where the civil unrest sputtered after Floyd's murder. But I fact-checked, and the store is exactly 1 mile from me. My spatial awareness has eroded over time, which is to be expected after decades of my home and my body being the nucleus of the universe. I am aware of the limitations of the personal essay, of how gazing down the rabbit hole of myself feels trite at best, and at worst diminishes a story's long-term tellability. But please bear with me as I try to make sense of the neighborhood that I've resided in since the birth of my brother Hussein in 2000 and the memories I associate with it. It was one of those spring days where the days preceding it blurrily collapsed together. The air was sticky, and I wasn't sure if it was the beginning of the month or the end of it. I marked the passage of time by whatever was on TV. With the way basic cable plans were structured, there wasn't that much to watch, so my sister Hufan and I biked for hours every day. We could only bike around the block because my mom was paranoid that we'd get abducted. We were unsupervised, after all, as both our parents worked long hours to afford the mortgage. When biking in circles in the baking sun felt redundant, we kept ourselves entertained the only way a couple of latchkey kids could, by stopping to admire pretty lawns, playing in our alley, and staring at passers-by. The longer we looked around, at least it seems to me now, the more every detail seemed profound, brimming with vibrancy and significance. I was the one who suggested one day that we peek inside an unmarked cardboard box in front of a rental building. I was known to do that, stick my nose in things. Blithely unconcerned with how I looked to myself, much less how I looked to others, I didn't quite know where my nose belonged yet. Back then, I wore dookie braids, oversized T-shirts, and basketball shorts like a uniform. The look was easier to pull off than the lifestyle that came with the cool girl Delia's catalog digs I fiended for. Being an unintentional tomboy was more accessible for a chubby black Somali girl whose family still hadn't hopscotched over the line from poor to lower middle class in the Powderhorn neighborhood of South Minneapolis. My sister and I careened on our bikes, stopping in front of the box. I lurched toward it, wobbling with the bike's tubes between my legs, and looked inside. It was filled with mail. I can't say I knew what my exact reasoning was for being so nosy, but I can say that my intention was not to commit a federal crime. But to the white man who ran up to us, threatening to call the cops on us, we were criminals. He ascribed bad intentions to our juvenile curiosity. Federal crime were his words, not mine, before we could even explain. All my words, "We didn't mean anything by it, we just wanted to look," were met with incredulity. I resent that we even needed to explain ourselves, that he couldn't just see how innocent we were on our faces. Fearing what he was capable of, we were familiar with Dateline and 60 Minutes. We at least had the channels those programs appeared on. We booked at home. We kept looking back at him as we jaggedly rounded the corner, stomping on the pedals. After that day, I would point my nose toward the sky, trying to appear incurious, or I would orient it toward the ground, trying to be inconspicuous. How I looked to my white neighbors if I gawked at a stranger's garden, touched anything in stores, or sustained eye contact with them for too long, may not have mattered before, but now it did. I became acutely aware, though I didn't have the language yet, that white people possess a sort of social-emotional illiteracy, a blind spot that impairs their ability to read the expressions on black faces. Fear in our eyes is criminality. Girly busybodiness is untrustworthiness, and everything we do is suspicious and racially coded. The clinical term for this is agnosia, which is usually caused by brain damage. Minneapolis, my backyard museum, has shown me many kinds of white people. I still can't, after all these years, say with certainty that all white people here are one way, but the act of qualifying general statements about white people is a fool's errand, and I like to save my futile optimism for important things, like the possibility of Rilo Kiley reuniting. I suppose if I had to accurately quantify how many white people I am referring to, almost all white people would be more apt. But almost all white people is imprecise in the specter of institutional racism. It doesn't roll off the tongue the way a sweeping pronouncement does. Next photo, a demonstrator in Minneapolis holds a picture of George Floyd. Most of our neighbors weren't like the man we encountered that day, but we learned that was only because that man didn't know us. The ones who knew us, assigned an infantilizing immigrant nobility to us. We could do no wrong in their eyes because of our African parents, which sounds cool at first, but not for all the people on the other side of that psychic barrier or on the other side of the city. On many occasions, my mother had to plead with our neighbor, let's call her Emma, a geriatric white woman who looks like, with the right wig, Kathy Bates could play her in a movie, to not call the cops on the black boyfriends of the two white neighbor girls across the alleyway. She couldn't see what my family saw, their intelligence, their kindness, their inherent dignity. She wanted to thoughtlessly interrupt their fun. Other neighbors, a Desi couple who owned the corner store on our block, introduced me to the intra-racial layers of this. They'd make black customers, primarily African Americans, come in the store one at a time. But my sister and I could enter in tandem to buy our Fruitopia and hot Cheetos, because they had encountered us vis-a-vis our parents first. Gentrification later did a David Copperfield-esque disappearing act with their little business, replacing it with an overpriced Holiday gas station. The intra-racial component factors into this city's problems. It's a symptom of white supremacy, so the finger can be pointed back at white people. But to only assign the blame to them is an oversimplification. A pattern that I've observed over time is that non-black people of color with any sort of relational power by dint of skin tone or class ambitions are active shareholders of black inequity here. It's not surprising, then, that an Arab American establishment got caught in a game of telephone with the Minneapolis police. tethering themselves to the cosmic chain of fault in George Floyd's death under the knee of Derek Chauvin as other cops watched him slowly suffocate. Even the indigenous population here, who have been systematically excluded the most, occasionally have their racial wounds and anxieties, which white people have continuously inflamed, brush up against black pain and injury, like in the case of the 2013 South High fights. The Somali American students, too, kicked and punched in every direction. Their own internal anti-blackness, like an autoimmune disease, externalized in the general direction of mostly African American students, while also being the main targets of the violence. The local news mischaracterized it as a food fight gone awry. My younger sister, Haban, a bystander who was there when the fighting erupted in her cafeteria, narrowly escaped being pummeled by the misplaced righteous rage of her peers that Valentine's Day. The brown and black student population tried cannibalizing each other like a scene out of Lord of the Flies. But the pendulum has swung again, and the critical mass is finally swelling toward liberation. On the 28th of May, 7 years since those fights, my sister was almost tear-gassed near the looted Target by a more formidable opponent, the police. When she came home, she told me of the exhilaration of the protest, how she'd left her glasses at home, but could still witness the beauty of the surrounding ruins. "It's really beautiful to look at. I love watching the flames. I love watching the residue of the ruins of things that once were. It's just beautiful." The next day, the same ruins proved to be a Rorschach ink blot, evidence of white people's social-emotional illiteracy, of how they can't read the anguished grins on our faces. Had they found it beautiful, too? It was hard to tell, but the optics, in good faith or not, of the care and cleanup crew, virtue-signaling with their brooms, seemed askew. At a traffic stop, I stuck my head out the window of our van and yelled in the direction of a white woman sweeping the sidewalk with her children, "Hey, you got any brooms left?" The woman replied sweetly, "Yes, do you need one?" I didn't time the joke, and we were still sitting at the stoplight, so I yelled back in the Minnesota nice way that all of the locals, regardless of race or ethnicity, deploy to passive-aggressively communicate with each other, "I'm kidding. Sorry." Thank you. summer reading fiction, sex, and vanity. The author of Crazy Rich Asians is back with a new satire dripping in luxury, with this riff on Forster, Perfectly Made for Our Times, by Kevin Kwan. Adapted from Sex and Vanity, a novel by Kevin Kwan, published by Doubleday, an imprint of the Knopf Doubleday Group, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC, copyright 2020, by Tyersall Park Limited. 821 Fifth Avenue, 17th floor. The chauffeur opened the door, and Renee and Cecil stepped from the Bentley onto the burgundy carpeting. Passed through the revolving doors of 821 Fifth Avenue and found themselves in the hushed, elegant Belgian Art Nouveau lobby. A pair of doormen dressed like deserters from the Franco-Prussian War gave them the once-over. "We're going up to Consuelo Barclay Churchill's." "I'm Cecil Pike," Cecil announced. The older doorman checked a list and a leather-bound logbook before giving them a curt nod. 17th floor, Mr. Pike. Ivan will show you the way." Even the doormen are snooty, Renee thought, as they were shown to the elevator by the younger doorman. She remembered walking past the building years ago when she first began house hunting in New York and admiring its splendid facade. Danielle, her property agent, had shaken her head and declared, "Don't even think about this one. It's a good building." Renee was confused. "If it's a good building, why can't we consider it?" "Sorry, let me explain. A good building in realtor code for the few buildings left in Manhattan with co-op boards that will never allow people of a certain background in." Renee's jaw tightened. "What do you mean by background? I have an MBA from Harvard and letters of reference from the governor of New York, Cardinal O'Connor, and Barbara Walters. Are you telling me we aren't qualified?" "It has nothing to do with your qualifications or references, Mrs. Pike, which I can assure you are sterling." "Then what is the problem?" Danielle lowered her voice to a whisper. "No Jews, Mrs. Pike, and that means no one with a drop of Hispanic blood either. You need to have come over on the Mayflower to get into this building." Now, Renee scrutinized herself one last time in the inlaid mirror of the elevator. With her expertly balayaged hair and her expensively sculpted nose, did she still look like she had any Hispanic blood coursing through her veins? "I can't wait to see this place," Cecil whispered in his mother's ear. "How much do you want to bet it's decorated like Frankie Campbell's?" The elevator opened onto an entrance hall, and both Renee and Cecil were taken aback by the sight of the enormous pair of Assyrian sphinxes that were at least 10 feet tall, flanking a faux marbre set of doors in vibrant malachite and turquoise. They could hear the murmur of the crowd just beyond the doors. This wasn't the typical sister parish meets Mark Hampton decor they had been expecting. The place had a sumptuous, exotic flair that exuded a relaxed grandeur. "Can you believe it? Old money with actual style," Cecil whispered to his mother. Renee scanned the room quickly, quietly impressed, as Cecil wondered if he had time to sneak a few pictures. "Stand there, Mother. I'm going to take a picture of you before anyone sees us." Cecil took a few covert shots on his phone before clearing his throat and asking in a loud voice, "Now, where's everyone?" "There they are," Lucy said, the relief evident in her voice as she caught sight of Cecil poking his head into the drawing room. She steered Cecil and his mother to the corner where her grandmother was perched on the edge of a deep-buttoned ottoman, chatting animatedly with her friends Jeanette and Alex. "Granny, here are Cecil and his mother Renee Pike," Lucy proudly announced. Lucy's grandmother stood up quickly, her posture still ramrod straight after more than 8 decades. "How do you do?" Good, good. Cecil is taller than I would have thought. And the mama's wearing Oscar from one of his last couture collections for Balmain. I almost bought that suit. She's much prettier in person than her pictures. No wonder she hooked her pike. Renee flashed her signature million-watt smile and said in her unabashed Texan drawl, Mrs. Churchill, it's such a pleasure at long last. I've been wanting to thank you in person for over 15 years now for rescuing the Württemberg tapestries and giving them to the cloisters. Grandma looks like Vanessa Redgrave, and she's wearing an Yves Saint Laurent dress with... Holy moly, are those Tina Chow rock crystal cuff bracelets? Not what I was expecting. This is one cool dame. You are much too well informed, Renee. That was supposed to be a secret, Consuelo said, a bit taken aback. I'm going to get everyone fired at the Met tomorrow. Cecil bowed ceremoniously. Mrs. Churchill, I can finally see where Lucy gets her artistic flair. Just look at this room. I'm dying for these moss-green stamped velvet walls and these Giacometti end tables. May I ask if Geoffrey Benison was somehow involved in this mise-en-scene? Stéphane, and there's a footnote here, Stéphane Boudin, one of the most influential interior designers of the 20th century. As president of the Paris-based interior decorating firm Maison Janson, he was the mastermind behind the restoration of the White House for Jacqueline Kennedy in 1961, and was also known for designing interiors for the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, C.Z. Guest, the Agnellis, and the royal families of Belgium and Iran. Stéphane did the original work for me, but yes, Geoffrey gave it a bit of a refresh in the late 70s, Consuelo replied, eyeing him curiously. He really did a marvelous job. It holds up beautifully. Tell me, that portrait of you over the fireplace, is that by Magritte? Cecil asked in amazement, staring at the painting of Consuelo's face, half obscured by clouds. Indeed it is. It was the last portrait he did, so I'm told, Consuelo said in the blasé tone of someone who'd uttered that statement 1,000 times. Despite this, Cecil was genuinely awed. He couldn't quite believe he was engaged to the granddaughter of a woman so fabulous. He was about to ask Consuelo if she wouldn't mind posing with her Magritte portrait and him for an Instagram shot when a portly man with a bushy silver mustache cut in front of him and gave Consuelo a hug. Ah, Harry, come meet Lucy's beau, Cecil Pike. Cecil, this is Harry Stuyvesant Fish, a dear family friend. He's about to become our ambassador to Norway. Congratulations, young man. I knew your grandfather. The illustrious ambassador-to-be, Ripawam Groton Harvard, said to Cecil as he pumped his hand jovially. Really? On which side? Cecil asked in astonishment. The Pike side, of course. My family had a camp up in the Adirondacks, too, on Upper Saranac. I'm sorry. My grandfather, to my knowledge, was never in the Adirondacks. He wasn't? Aren't you Cecil Pike the Fourth? I'm afraid not. Where did your family summer? Usually in Europe. For a few summers, my parents rented a villa in the south of... Harry cut him off. You're not one of the Pikes who married into the Livingstons? No, Cecil said, reddening a little. Ah, well then. Harry turned away abruptly and reached out to a passing lady, grabbing her by the shoulder. Helen, I haven't seen you since Michael Corda's talk at the Century. Where's Frank tonight? Recovering himself, Cecil realized that Consuelo was still standing there, eyeing him like a hawk. Before he could say anything, she turned to the assembled crowd, picked up a flute of champagne, and began knocking the glass with her Elitop intaglio ring. Everyone, quiet. I'm going to make a toast. Consuelo turned to Lucy with a smile and began, Now, when I first set eyes on Lucy a week after she was born, she was in her crib. and I must confess, with her peachy white cheeks and delicate black eyelashes, I thought she looked like the most adorable, exquisite little China doll. So, ever since, she has been my little China doll. She would never, ever cry. She was so quiet and well-mannered, and I would dress her up in the finest silk costumes from the Orient, sent to me by my dear friend Han Xuan, and I would take her to lunch at La Grenouille, where everyone would fuss over her, or to tea at Madame Chiang Kai-shek's. Funnily enough, Madame Chiang always argued with me and told me that my little China doll didn't look Chinese enough. "Look at those freckles," she would say. "That's no Chinese baby." "Well, she's half Churchill," I would reply, "but thank God she didn't inherit the Churchill nose." Oh, how we had so many laughs back then, and how I wish those days would last forever. But babies do grow up, and Lucy became a scholar, graduating magna cum laude in biology from Brown, which was only to be expected since she clearly gets all her brains from her mother's side. And now she so quickly made a name for herself in the art world as one of New York's top contemporary advisors. She continues to surprise us all, and I know her father would be so proud if he could see her today. Now Lucy has met her match in Cecil, who I'm told was proclaimed one of the most eligible bachelors in the country, and hails from such an impressive family, one that has become so synonymous with diversity and the philanthropic spirit of this country. Why, every museum I go to these days, I see Mrs. Pike's name carved into the wall. Cecil, I've only just met you, but I can tell you possess the refinement of a Rothschild, and I trust you will know exactly how to treat my precious, precious China doll. To Lucy and Cecil, I wish you both a lifetime of joy and happiness. Everyone in the room raised their glasses as Freddie cheered, "Hear, hear." Renee beamed proudly at her son, thinking, "My boy did good. Those effers at St. James School in Houston wouldn't accept him. But look at him now, marrying into the elite of the elite, the kind of people who have never even heard of St. James." Lucy blinked back a few tears, though no one in the room, with perhaps the exception of her mother, would have ever suspected the real reason. After making a few rounds of the drawing room, Cecil and Lucy managed to duck out to the building's roof garden for a little fresh air. Cecil gave Lucy a dead-eyed stare. "Effing hell, I have half a mind to get out my cell phone now and call for a helicopter evac right now." Lucy burst out laughing. "I did warn you. Baby, I don't think you prepared me adequately. I thought Charlotte was bad enough, but I've never in my life met such dreadful people. So stultifyingly boring, so shabbily costumed, they might as well be wax figures. How could you possibly be related to them? I just don't see it. You are the swan in a field of squawking geese, the rare lotus growing in a swamp. Oh, you're too sweet. I'm the weird-looking one in my family, you know. Khaki's considered the beautiful one. She was a Ford model back in her Wellesley years. Khaki? She sure looks like a Ford, and I'm talking about a Bronco. Thank God for your mother, or you'd have the same unfortunate inbred features. You're too funny. You sound like my Tang grandparents, my mom's folks. Whenever they saw me, they would always praise my features. To them, Freddie and I were the most beautiful creatures in the world, and they were always so proud to show me off to their friends that it made me a little embarrassed. But to some of the people downstairs, it was the polar opposite. It was always, what can we do to fix Lucy? Cecil shook his head in disgust. Well, in my opinion, you're the only person downstairs who doesn't need fixing. That Annifred, there's no excuse for her name. Did she escape from an order of lesbian Mennonites? Fess up. Annifred and Teddy are really brother and sister, aren't they? They can't possibly be married to each other. Lucy was doubled over in laughter. I always thought Teddy and Annifred look exactly alike, but you're the first person to ever say it. She's actually Annifred the Ninth. Her family goes all the way back to the landing at Plymouth Rock. Oh, dear God, pilgrims. You're related to pilgrims? No wonder you needed me to rescue you from this pathetic lot. You have no idea. Freddy can do no wrong in their eyes, but I've always felt like I'm on probation. I'm only part of the family if I don't embarrass them. Ha, I think you've got it mixed up. You should be embarrassed of them. Lucy grinned, delighting in Cecil's dissection of her kin. It was as if she had found a kindred spirit at last, like they were the two outsiders at the back of the classroom, making snide remarks about the popular kids. And that friend of your grandmother's, Ambassador Harry Stuyvesant Fish, what century is he from? Did anyone inform him that we won the War of Independence? Oh, Harry's the worst. When I was at Brown, he could never stop making disparaging remarks about it. He called it a repository for ne'er-do-wells and the dregs of deposed European royalty. I don't understand how this man is going to be an ambassador. He wouldn't know what diplomacy was if it hit him on his fat head. At first, he snubbed me when he realized I wasn't descended from some posh Pikes he knew. But then, when he was introduced to my mother and realized I was that Pike, you should have seen how quickly he did a 180 and began to grovel in her presence. He reminded me of a truffle hog, especially with that red face and that distended belly. That is one man who should never go near a pair of suspenders, and yet there he is, there he was, in his Brooks Brothers braces. He looked like... what was the name of the guy who used to do those ghastly Quaker Oats commercials when we were little kids? Wilfred Ross? Wilfred Brimley, Lucy cackled. Cecil could really be so funny sometimes, especially when he was feeling affronted. Harry was going on and on in that pretentious accent about he was due to begin his posting in Oslo and still didn't have tenants for his estate in East Hampton because he couldn't find the right sort of people. It seems the ones who are rich enough to afford the place don't meet his standards. No private equity, oil, or tech money. No one from New Jersey, Southern California, or Southern anywhere. And no Latins because they like to dance. He said this in front of my mother, mind you. He said they would ruin the 18th-century mahogany floors of his Sissinghurst, which is on the National Register of Historic Places. Who is he kidding? I've seen the place, and it looks like a Victorian bordello on mushrooms. All those turrets and Tiffany glass windows, it's an abomination. He should put it on Craigslist and rent it out by the hour. More importantly, how dare he name it Sissinghurst? It's an insult to Vida and Harold. It was his mother's house, Sissy Van Degen Fish. She was apparently the mother from hell. Perhaps Harry would take the Ortiz sisters. They just emailed me asking if I knew of a good house to rent in the Hamptons, Lucy wondered. Who are the Ortiz sisters? Are they anything like the Borromeo sisters, the Miller sisters, the Bograd sisters, or the Yeo sisters? Should I know them? You might enjoy them. I got to know them at Isabel de Vecchi's wedding. Ah, yes. They were part of that strange crew you met in Capri before destiny caused our paths to cross in Rome. They were these rather proper but very charming sisters, Paloma and Mercedes. And they weren't the strange ones, Lucy said, suddenly getting a faraway look in her face. Don't Filipinos like to dance? I doubt the Honorable Ambassador would approve of these party animals. They're in their 70s, Cecil, and they come from one of the oldest and most revered families in the Philippines. Well, then, don't let me stop you from fulfilling Harry Stuyvesant Fish's social wet dreams. In the meantime, can't I please call in a helicopter and let's head straight to Daniel? I would love nothing more than to leave this miserable party, but I don't think there's enough landing room among these azaleas, and we need to make at least one more round and rescue your mother. Besides, I really think my great-aunt Cushing has taken a fancy to you. I swear, I saw great-aunt Cushing squirrel some of those mini-quiches from William Paul into that big wicker tote bag of hers. I think she's begun stocking up for winter. Oh, dear, she's always the first to attack the leftovers after dinner. Last year, I heard she brought a huge nylon fold-out bag to the Casita Maria Fiesta Gala to take home as many of the centerpieces as she could fit. Of course she did. Baby, please don't make me go back down there. Everyone's so wretched. Now that we've done this, do we need to invite any of them to the wedding? Would any of them even want to go to Abu Dhabi? The only one who's fabulous is your grandmother. She's absolutely magnificent, and the apartment exceeded all my expectations. Tell me, who do you think she's going to leave the Magritte to? Don't go getting any ideas, Cecil. I can assure you it won't be me. Khaki's my grandmother's favorite, because she looks like a young Charlotte Rampling and lets her win at bridge. Khaki was another one who was so far up my mother's ass. She was name-dropping a mile a minute. Mandela, Macron, Marie-José. Lucy shook her head in amused disgust. I'm glad you see Khaki for who she is. All my life I felt like I've had to try to live up to her goddess-like perfection. Cecil scrunched his face up like a bad smell had wafted past. What would ever possess you to think that Khaki was worth competing against? I'm not even sure anymore. I guess, growing up, we were like the wretched orphans, especially after Dad died and Mom got sick. I felt responsible for keeping our family together, and that meant always striving to be perfect in Granny's eyes. You are perfect exactly the way you are, baby, Cecil said, stroking her cheek affectionately. You were the most exquisite thing in that room tonight, and even if your grandmother has poor judgment, at least she made a marvelous toast. Anyone who can mention Han Xuyen, Madame Chiang Kai-shek, and the Rothschilds in the same toast deserves a prize. Didn't you think it was fabulous? It was, Lucy said softly. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.